Thank you so much, President Byerly. This is really what a beautiful day we have here to celebrate, right? And by the way, that was a really nice introduction. I appreciate that. But really, most people are just interested in my guide dog. He was part of the procession. I think he was maybe the first guide dog to be part of the procession today. But we were walking by, and a cute little kid said, "Wow, there's our speaker. Look at his dog." So, of course, I'm just the guy with the dog. I was giving a talk once, and I was sitting in the second front row ready to go up on stage, and these two guys were sitting in front of me. They didn't know I was the speaker. And one turned to his friend, and he whispered, "I hope this guy isn't boring." And his friend whispered back, "Well, if he is, you know, he's blind. We can just walk out. He will know the difference." So in the meantime, I did train my dog to attack anyone who makes any sudden movements. So don't feel like you can escape. But that is a nice introduction with lots of accomplishments. But I think what doesn't get talked about enough is not the accomplishments, but the struggle. Because it really has been a struggle to embrace what I call a no barriers life. To look and examine these smaller journeys that make up our lives, that are constantly ending and beginning anew, that are so big and daunting and uncertain that we can't see the finish line. And I've been trying to explore what that life looks like as long as I can remember, trying to define it, honestly, mostly just failing it and bleeding it. And I think I got a little bit closer to understanding what it means a few summers ago when I was running one of my No Barriers clinics. We were climbing a mountain in Colorado. We had some diverse people as part of our team, blind people who were using trekking poles, and we were jingling bear bells in front of them so they could navigate, and paraplegics cranking their way up the mountain with their arms. And the night before the clinic, Kyle showed up. And Kyle was born without arms and legs. We had no idea how we were going to get him to the top of the mountain. But we were no barriers, and we had to scramble. So that night, we came up with a terrible idea. We went to his hotel room, and we took some bath towels. And we went to the front desk, and we got some packing tape and some foam. And the next morning, we pushed him to the base of the mountain and took him out of his chair, wrapped his stumps up with foam and packing tape and bath towels. And for the next 8 hours, Kyle crabbed his way through dirt, over rocks, through snow, to the top of a 12,000-foot peak in Colorado. See, it doesn't take a lot to get started. These are just little sparks of ideas, and we take those materials and we combine them with the light of the human spirit, and we will go to amazing places. And by the way, that wasn't enough for Kyle. He could have just stood there and said, "I'm done. I've summited." But instead, he used that as a catalyst to more growth in his life. He continued to build his systems and tools and technologies and strengthen his team. And the next January, it was after 16 days on the mountain, that Kyle became the first quadruple amputee to reach the summit of Kilimanjaro, the tallest peak in Africa. But I want to start by saying something that maybe, thank you. I want to start by saying something that maybe sounds a little shocking coming from the commencement speaker, and that is that I hate when people tell me anything is possible. If that were true, I'm pretty sure I'd be racing NASCAR. That phrase undermines all that it takes, all that I understand as you push against these barriers that try to knock you flat on your back as you try to pursue a life that matters. I think barriers are real. They're real in the world, not just in mountains, not just in rivers, but all around us. I was walking through the airport the other day, and my dog, he didn't look up. I don't know why these bars stick into space, but I walked right into a metal bar. I flew back. I was laying on my back in the slushy snow, blood pouring down my face into my eyes. I promise you, I wasn't thinking, you know, barriers are only in the mind. No. Nope. They're real, and they hurt. They hurt a lot. I wrote a book called The Adversity Advantage. I teamed up with this scientist, Dr. Paul Stoltz. And Paul had studied people and teams around the world, and he came away understanding that people consistently fall into three categories. They're either quitters, campers, or climbers. Now, quitters are self-explanatory. We're not going to talk about them today. By the fact that you're here today, you're not a quitter. But campers are a fascinating group because, well, they make up the majority of the world. They're those people who start out climbing, as we all do, and somewhere along our ascent, we stop. A number of things can happen. We can lose belief in ourselves or in the cause, or we can say enough time and pain and energy, I'm in a safe spot. Or maybe catastrophic changes sweep over the landscape and we feel ill-equipped to confront the mountain. Or maybe barriers like brick walls, they just keep getting in the way and they shove us to the sidelines and now we're camping. Personally, we're stagnating. But more importantly, our energy, our potential, our life force, it's all lost to the world. Climbers are a rare group. They're those people who figure out a way to grow and evolve and innovate and attack problems and challenge themselves every day of their lives till the day they die. So I think the question is this. How do we climb? Like in Kyle's case, it makes so much more sense. It is so much easier to camp. My journey was an actual literal climbing journey. I wanted to climb the seven summits, the tallest peak in every continent. I started with Denali, 20,300 feet, the tallest peak in North America. I flew ski planes onto the Kehiltna Glacier, and it was 19 days later, we crossed the summit ridge towards the summit. 4:30 in the afternoon turned out to be Helen Keller's birthday that we stood on top. And we were so worried about getting down, but we were also exhilarated because we had timed it perfectly. We had radioed down to a small airstrip near the mountain, and now as we were nearing the top, my family, my dad, my two brothers, my wife, they were all circling above us in a plane watching us take our last steps. And we had these red suits on, so we looked identical to each other as climbers. And we're waving our ski poles at the plane. We're cheering. And I said to Jeff, my climbing partner, I said, Jeff, do you think they'll know I made it? He said, yeah, they're going to know. You're the only one waving your ski pole in the wrong direction. It's good to have friends. And we got down to our igloo that I built. We built up there. I sat inside that igloo as cold, as tired as I was. I'd never done something so physically, mentally demanding. A part of me knew I wasn't cut out for this life. I wasn't tough enough. I wasn't resilient enough. This is the last thing a blind person should be doing with his life. But the other half of me didn't care. The other half of me wanted to figure out how to climb forever. And Chris Morris, who is our team leader, he cooked up a big pot of celebratory freeze-dried spaghetti, which I immediately gave back to the mountain gods. Yeah, everyone had to crawl through it to get out of the igloo. That's a side story. But Chris is from Alaska, and he's got these wonderful philosophies, these wonderful witticisms. I love them. You know, you're sitting out in this terrible storm. You're miserable. You can't believe you're even there. Chris will look up, big smile on his face. He'll say something like, sure is cold out here, but at least it's windy. Or he'll say, we sure have been climbing a long way, but at least we're lost. On the top of Aconcagua, 23,000 feet, I got to the summit behind Chris. He gave me a big hug. He said, Biggie, he said, you may be blind, but you sure are slow. I wasn't expecting that. I said, Chris, you know, you're not the nicest guy I've ever met, but at least you're stupid. But I love positive pessimisms. Use them, you know, it's such a wonderful way to say, hey, it's a tough road ahead. It always will be. But we own that road. It doesn't own us. You know, maybe in a few months you could use one. I'm living in my parents' basement, but at least I have another 20 years to pay off my college loans. No, maybe not. Hopefully not. But back in the igloo, I said, Chris, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to throw up in the entrance of the igloo. He did something so nice. He slapped me on the back as hard as he could. He said, Biggie, he said, anyone who stands on the top of North America, I'll crawl through his puke any day. And he did. He crawled right through. I was touched. And I've had such a good time in the mountains, climbing to the tops of mountains, coming down with friends around me. Summits are very much goals. You know, they're linear. They're step by step. And I know all of you have multitudes of goals that are very important. But in my life, and maybe in yours too, what's been more important than any one goal has been a vision. I see a vision differently than many people. It's more of an internal vision, a vision of how we see ourselves living our lives, serving others, impacting the world, what kind of legacy we want to leave behind us. And I think sometimes we focus on these long lists of goals. They can become isolated and fragmented and go unfinished, or maybe even spin out of control and lead us in directions that we never wanted to go to. When I think we need to continually reconnect with that unifying vision that takes those goals and binds them together and gives them purpose and power, first has to come a vision. It's a manifestation of our values. It's our values in action. It's one thing, as you know, to create a vision. It's that word gets thrown around a lot. But it's another thing entirely to believe in it so strongly we're able to summon up the courage and the discipline and the focus to live within its framework. For instance, as soon-to-be graduates, I mean, your vision is powerful. If your vision is to change the world, how then do you align your goals day after day after day to bring you towards that vision? If your vision is to shatter people's perceptions of what's possible, how do your goals do it? If your vision is not to respond and react, but to lead, how do you take those goals and wrap them around that vision and make it real? I think a vision is like an internal compass. It guides us through good weather, more importantly through bad weather, and it gives us clues of where we're going and why it's so important we get there. I think every great ascent begins with a vision. When I went blind from this very rare eye disease, I wasn't thinking about a vision. I was just thinking about survival, just getting through the day. Blindness was like a storm that had descended upon me. I was being led to class, led to the bathroom, led into the cafeteria, sitting at a table by myself, listening to all the excitement and laughter and joy passing me by. I wasn't afraid to go blind. What I was afraid of most was that I would be swept aside into a dark place. I would be left there, and I would be forgotten. That I would have no ability to impact my world. My life would be meaningless, a life lived for nothing. That was terrifying. And I could still see a tiny bit out of my right eye. If I got close to the TV, I could press my face up and watch. And I was watching a show one night, and they were focusing on a guy. His name was Terry Fox, as you heard. Terry was a Canadian. He had lost a leg to cancer, and he was still in the hospital when he decided that he was going to run across Canada. This is thousands of miles. This is a marathon a day. This is not the natural decision a person in his situation was supposed to make. But it was as though Terry understood that between the things that happen to you and the ways that you are supposed to react, there's a space. And in that space, there's a choice. It's never an easy choice, but it's still a choice. And he chose to attack. And he was watching children die of cancer around him in the hospital. And instead of allowing that darkness to crush him, Terry took that energy and he gathered it up and he converted it to something different, maybe purpose. And he used that purpose as fuel to power him every faltering step along the road. The miles took a terrible toll on his body, on his stump. The look on his face was an absolute contradiction, full of exhaustion, yet at the same time, full of exaltation. And I thought to myself, there's something inside of Terry, I could only describe it at the time as a light, that seemed to be able to feed on frustration, on setbacks. In fact, to use those things as fuel, the greater the challenge, the brighter that light kept burning. And I hoped that that light existed in me. And if I could feed it and nurture it, and use that light to turn into the storm of life and emerge on the other side, not just unscathed, not just damaged as little as possible, but actually stronger and better. And it was a few months after that I got this newsletter. A group taking blind kids rock climbing. I ran my hand up the wall of my room. I thought, who would be insane enough to take a blind kid rock climbing? So I signed up. I was tired of building walls around myself, protecting myself. Like Terry Fox, I wanted to attack. And I found through trial and error, I could use my hands and my feet as my eyes. I could scan my hands and feet across the face just before I was ready to lose strength in my forearms and fingers. I felt like I had to fall. I'd find just enough to dig my fingers into a crack or a pocket just to keep me stuck to the face so I could do another pull-up, scan my other hand. I left a lot of blood and skin on the rock that first time. I got to the top. It was so exhilarating. It was so vibrant. It was almost painful. It was like a rebirth. I gotta say, though, as vibrant and beautiful as it was also scary. And there's one thing that has not changed since that very first time I went rock climbing 30 years ago. That's the reach. It doesn't matter whether you can see or not. We're all in the same boat. We're all reaching into darkness. We're predicting and calculating. We're hoping. We're praying. All our algorithms and metrics, they lead us to believe that we're going to find what we're looking for, but we understand there's no guarantee. It's that moment when we've reached out our minds, our bodies, we've committed to the reach, we know it's almost impossible to turn back. Those fears, they're overwhelming. The fear of flopping on our face, of making a mistake, of learning that we're not as good at something as we wanted to be, the fear of giving 100% of ourselves and still falling short. All these fears, they conspire against us and they paralyze us. When I think there's a big difference between many people and those who fully understand that life is an ongoing, never-ending process of reaching out into the darkness when we don't know exactly what we'll find. We're constantly reaching towards immense possibilities. They're always unseen, yet they are sensed, while so many others allow that darkness to paralyze them. I reached out that day. I know you've reached out many, many days. You're about to embark on some big reaches. But here's the problem. There's always a but. Because when we reach out in that way, and we try to climb higher and higher up the mountain, we will bring adversity into our lives. It's like we're asking for it. In fact, there's a relationship between the extent of our reach and the amount of adversity we embrace in our lives. The two go hand in hand, adversity and greatness. And I think this relationship works just as powerfully in reverse, because when we examine those existing barriers around us and we attack them in the right way, we can release tremendous energy and potential within us. I don't think it's enough just to keep up with the pace of change or solve problems. That just gets us behind. I think we have to be relentless. We have to identify those adversities around us, the ones that wear us down, that make us feel like we're treading water, but we're still drowning, right up to the most complex issues that face us as human beings on the horizon, ready to bear down on us. It takes a lot of courage not to avert our eyes, but to square off with adversity, to walk into the storm. The best example I've ever seen of a person able to do this, he's a friend of mine. His name is Mark Wellman. When Mark was in his 20s, he was a brilliant climber. He was coming down a peak in the Sierra Nevadas. He was benighted, which means he got lost on the mountain after nightfall. He fell 150 feet. He broke his back. He was paralyzed from the waist down. And he decided that he would climb again. And he went out and he developed this new system. No one had ever seen anything like it. His partner anchors the rope, and then Mark has a pull-up bar that locks into the rope. He does a pull-up. He slides up the rope on an ascender, and he pushes the bar up. He pulls himself up. He pushes the bar up. He pulls himself up. He only gets about 6 inches up with each pull-up. He climbed El Capitan, 3,000-foot overhanging granite monolith in Yosemite Valley. They estimated he did over 7,000 pull-ups in 8 days. I call people like Mark, I call them alchemists. You remember those medieval sorcerers trying to take lead and turn it into gold? These are modern-day alchemists, the people that can take all the lead that life piles on top of them and transform it into gold. With an alchemist, they don't do the traditional things that you hear about. They don't deal well with adversity or avoid it. What they do is to seize hold of that storm of adversity that swirls around us, to harness its energy, and use that energy to propel themselves forward to places they would have never gone to in any other way. With an alchemist, you can throw them in the midst of a fierce, uncertain environment, strip away their resources, throw roadblocks in front of them, and they'll still find a way to win, not despite adversity, because of it. I think if we want to win and grow and innovate and change the paradigm that the world follows, the way we harness those challenges in our lives, it's our greatest advantage. Imagine that while the world is digging in its heels, focused on survival, you're using the energy of this momentous occasion to drive forward, to make big, bold leaps forward. What if adversity weren't the enemy? What if it were the pathway to greatness? There's a lot of adversity in the world that you're entering. Climate change and natural disasters and environmental disasters and a reliance on fossil fuels, poverty and disease, a clash of cultures and ideologies that compete around the world. Those things may be what crushes us, or they may become the most potent fuel source we have for transformation. See, I think the world is crying out for alchemy, and you may be the alchemist. You may be the world's best hope for alchemy. But I don't think it's enough just to harness adversity and achieve those summits, stand on top and say, look at me, and now dig in and get safe and build that empire around us. I think we need to use our summits to elevate others. For me, that came 12 years ago when I teamed back up with Mark Wellman, that paraplegic climber who'd climbed El Capitan. We were so impressed and inspired by the way that each of us had attacked our barriers and found ways through them, that we decided to begin what we knew we hoped someday would become a movement. We actually call it No Barriers. Our mission is to help people with challenges, that's most of us, to tap into the light of the human spirit, to break through barriers, to find purpose, so that they can contribute back to the world. We build a team, a community of pioneers, people who have pushed the envelope in science and technology and innovation and art and music. People like Amanda Boxtel. Amanda was in a wheelchair for 30 years. At our last experience, she stood up on the stage using an exoskeleton technology. She walked down the stairs, she pointed at a group of wheelchair users in the front row, and she said, get ready to walk. That's no barriers. But don't walk away from this address thinking that this is a message for those who can't see or can't walk. Don't let yourselves off the hook. This is about you. No barriers lives in you. It's your story. No barriers is about how you construct that map and use it to navigate forward in your lives. I think No Barriers is also a pledge that despite the challenges that we all have, that we can build the tools and the mindset to break through those barriers, to live the life that we envision. See, I think there's a lot of adversity out there. You're going to find it's very hard to predict the future. And I imagine, I guarantee, there are going to be mornings where you wake up and you feel like you are climbing blind. But see, I don't think this is the time to lose our will, to be clouded by fear, to be swept aside and be forgotten. I think this is the best time, the most precious time in history, to build that vision of our lives that will sustain us, to reach out into the darkness and along the way to take lead and turn it into gold. We do this for ourselves. You do it for your school, for your family, for your country. But I think most importantly, we climb for the sake of this wondrous world that we live in. As Lafayette, class of 2015, I want to leave you with one very simple message, and that is the fundamental belief behind No Barriers, that the light within you is stronger than the barriers in your way. Continue, commit to flourishing, to nurturing, to growing that light. Let it shine and use it as the fuel for your great climb ahead. Thank you very much. Congratulations.